Great Lives is a download from Radio 4. We hope you enjoy what you're about to hear. A few times on this programme, we've profiled people whose nomination as Great Lives has seemed a little contentious. Richard Nixon and Erwin Rommel spring to mind. Or Alexander the Great, perhaps. Or Attila the Hun. But never, I think, one whose reputation has oscillated so violently between villain and hero as today's subject, or inspired such passionate feelings about his personality. And it's a long story, too, from his death in 1485 to the day in 2013 when this announcement was made.
Archaeologists say a skeleton found beneath a car park in Leicester is that of King Richard III.
It is the academic conclusion of the University of Leicester that, beyond reasonable doubt, the individual exhumed at Greyfriars in September 2012 is indeed Richard III, the last Plantagenet King of England.
That piece of archive from The World at One in February 2013 must still be ringing in the ears of today's guest, screenwriter and secretary of the Scottish branch of the Richard III Society, Philippa Langley, who led the search for Richard's remains. Philippa, welcome to Great Lives. I think perhaps you'll agree that at one time Richard's life would definitely not have been considered a candidate for greatness. The caricature of him was of a nasty man who smothered his nephews in the Tower. But now here you are, championing his as a great life.
I am, Matthew. And I think what I would say, sort of in a nutshell with this, is, you know, history is written by the winners. And when Richard died on the field of Bosworth, a new dynasty was born, and that dynasty had to legitimise itself. And by doing that, it had to denigrate Richard, in a sense, because it had to show them as being the new choice.
So he's
been
trashed.
He's been trashed, I think, definitely. And then Shakespeare, of course, comes along again in the Tudor era. So we have the popular perception of Richard as the archetypal evil villain. And that plays based on Thomas More. And then we have many of the subsequent writers and historians believe, you know, that Thomas More is a credible source and a credible witness. So it's an amalgamation, I think, of those three very, very powerful things that really wrote Richard's story off completely.
How did you first become convinced that Richard had become maligned? And what made you then go to join the Richard III Society?
In 1998, I read a biography on Richard III by Paul Murray Kendall. And Kendall was using the historical sources to talk about a man who was loyal, brave, pious, and just. So I was incredibly intrigued by this portrayal because I wanted to try and understand how this fitted with what we kind of knew about Richard from the Tudor writers and Shakespeare. So then I joined the Richard III Society to try and find out how this worked, how we could get two very different opinions of the same man.
You felt this was a man whose story had never really been properly told.
Yes, and I couldn't understand why.
Well, our expert witness today has written a book called Richard III, The Maligned King. She's the historical biographer, Annette Carson. Annette, in profiling Richard, how have you gone about looking for the real man behind the Shakespearean version?
Well, where Richard III is concerned, I summarise it by saying we are dealing with an amalgam of deduction, surmise, conjecture and cynicism viewed through the propaganda of his enemies and topped off with a fantasy figure invented by Shakespeare. So my task is to question these assumptions, and I do that by going back to the original 15th century sources, because you just have to set aside sources that have no value as evidence.
What are these sources, the original sources?
You can summarise sources in sort of categories. Let's say the first category is just plain factual. Government papers, financial accounts, legal archives and so on. Those you just have to piece together like a jigsaw. There's another category which consists of personal notes and correspondence by people, which is great, actually, because that's immediate. But the trouble is you have to know that these people knew what they were talking about and weren't just recounting gossip. And the third category is the one that we're all most familiar with, and that is the narratives and reports. And they're usually written by chroniclers or diplomats or people who have some reason for writing an account of what's going on at the time. And it seems to be that they provide a nice, reliable story, but the trouble is they almost always have an agenda.
Well, let's have a look at this life. Let's start, Philippa, with a little context. Richard was born in 1452 in the midst of the Wars of the Roses. What were the circumstances of his birth?
Well, he was born into a very sort of difficult period, actually, because there'd been a lot of unrest. There was a tussle for the throne. His father had been named king by right, and it pretty much was a civil war.
Annette?
He was the youngest son of the Duke of York of the Royal Plantagenet dynasty, and he was born in the reign of King Henry VI. Now, King Henry VI behaved abominably to Richard's father, the Duke of York, and as a result, fighting broke out, and that's what we now call the Wars of the Roses. So Richard knew a lot of fear and hardship in his childhood because he had that background to contend with.
Was he destined to be king? Did he know?
Never. No, he was never death. He was the youngest son of somebody who certainly claimed that he had a senior right to the throne, but there were older brothers before Richard, so there was really no expectation that Richard would succeed to the throne.
Mm. And where did the rumours about the withered arm and the crooked back start? Do they start quite young?
No, they absolutely
no.
Sorry, they
absolutely
start with Thomas More.
Nobody mentioned it. No contemporaneous sources mention it.
No, lots of people met Richard and wrote about Richard. Not a single person said, you know, he was lame or a limping gait or a withered arm or anything like that. Nothing at all.
Which is why Ricardians, of course, Ricardian scholars, have never taken it seriously that he had any of those grotesque.
But would Thomas More just have made it up?
Yes.
Yes.
On the other hand, when his body was discovered, was it not claimed in support of the belief that this was Richard, that he had a twisted back?
Well, what happened was when they uncovered the remains and showed me at the dig, the specialist who was there said that this skeleton had kyphosis. And kyphosis is when the head is pushed forward and onto the chest. This totally shocked me because I'd spent by this time 10, 12 years researching this man. And what was very clear to me was that he was very physically active and very physically able. He'd fought in three battles, of course, at Bosworth. He'd done a cavalry charge on horseback. But in the other two battles, he'd fought on foot, hand to hand, over a number of hours. And even in his first battle, he was described as being a Hector, because he was right at the front and taking a full part in the battle. And we also have his itinerary as king. The man was never off a horse. Mm. He continually travelled. I thought, this can't be Richard then. These remains cannot be his. Because how can somebody with kyphosis fight on a battlefield with such a limited view? Because they'd be looking towards the floor.
Yeah.
How on earth can you fight? So that was a real shocker for me. But what happened was when they got him back to the laboratory and they were able to actually have a look at him, what they realised was that the grave had been cut too short for his body, so that his head was forward and onto his chest in the grave. So it's the irony of ironies of all the people in all the world to discover in a dig whose grave is cut too short.
Yes.
And they're looking like that. It had to be him.
And this is now agreed, is it, Annette? The reason the head seemed, the neck seemed too short was that it had been cut to go into the grave.
He was in a twisted position, and after he was exhumed, obviously his body was laid out, and it became absolutely clear that the only thing that was wrong with him was scoliosis, which is a sideways curve of the spine, which makes one shoulder a little higher than the other. No withered arm, no limp, no nothing. Perfectly sound body apart from that.
And to give you some context about sort of what scoliosis is, it's, you know, it's this one shoulder slightly higher than the other, which you probably wouldn't notice in somebody. And it doesn't stop you being very physically active and physically able. I mean, Usain Bolt, for example, has a scoliosis.
Let's get to the king who is finally slain in battle, only to be discovered all that
time afterwards underneath the car park. How did he come to be king?
He became the military general,
yes,
of his brother, the king. He was relied upon to be the man who was the commander of the military forces. And by the time that his brother, Edward the Fourth, died, and we're reaching 1480-odd now, by that time, Richard was basically head of the military, and he acted as Edward's general. Now, when Edward the Fourth died, we had children who were his successors. And this was a huge problem, because the eldest boy was only 12 years old. And unfortunately, he had been in the care of the Queen's family, the Woodvilles, who then made a bid for power. And they blocked the appointment of Richard as protector. Now, that was the job that he should logically have taken. It was the constitutional route, and it's the equivalent of, you might say, head of Homeland Security.
Yes.
They tried to get the 12-year-old Edward V crowned immediately so that he could reign in his own right and they could influence and be the power behind the throne. And Richard, when he arrived in London, walked into a political storm. The Woodvilles cleaned out the treasury to equip a fleet and troops, and they were marching on London with an army 2,000 strong. But fortunately for him, the King's Council backed Richard, and he became protector. And that is how the situation was set up during the month of May, until suddenly in the month of June, the former chancellor of the late king came forward with the information that the king's marriage had been bigamous. And as a result of a bigamous marriage, the offspring are illegitimate. And you had a succession crisis there. The king's council knew that the representatives of the three estates of parliament were going to be in London. They put the dilemma before them, and they debated it. And the upshot was that the three estates framed a petition in writing to Richard to take the throne as the adult heir.
And not the children.
Of that,
yes.
And not the children.
Yeah.
And that petition still exists in the National Archives if you ever want to see it.
So Richard has been declared to be the king or king-elect. There are nevertheless these two princes whose title has been declared void, but no doubt are still going to be a likely source of controversy. They are smothered in the Tower, are they? And by whom? Tell me.
There is no evidence that they're smothered, and there's no evidence that anything happened to them in the Tower. And there's no evidence of who might have been involved in either of those two unlikely things.
They disappeared, however. I think we can agree that, can't we?
What we haven't gone into is the fact that the Woodville family at this time was stoking up rebellion. So that to have the two children in the Tower in the middle of London while there's a rebellion being stoked up around them is obviously not the best thing to do. And the obvious thing, which everybody must have been expecting, was that they would be moved from the centre of things. They would be moved from the Tower. Now, this also supports my view that they were not killed in the Tower, because it's a royal palace. It's got 600 people working there. It's got the royal mint, it's got the menagerie, it's got the garrison, it's got the crown jewels, it's got, you know, this is the Tower of London. It's a busy, busy place. And to my mind, you cannot kill two royal children in a royal palace and have it remain utterly secret.
All right, let's accept that they weren't killed in the Tower, and let's accept that they weren't smothered. Nevertheless, let me lay the facts as I see them before you. Richard is about to be king, wants to be king, knows there's a challenge. The challenge includes two young princes. The two young princes appear to disappear, presumably killed by somebody. You must accept that the finger of suspicion does point in Richard's direction, doesn't it?
Well, it has done for pretty much 500 years, but when you actually look into the evidence that's there and you actually look into the balance of probabilities, if they died, who killed them? lawyers, policemen, investigators, psychologists, they've all looked into this question, and they've looked at motive, opportunity, and proclivity to kill. And they've all come out with exactly the same response, that in their assessment, it is very clear that Richard III is not the prime suspect. And the reason he's not the prime suspect is that you have to look at who had the most to gain by killing those two boys. Now, for Henry Tudor and his affinity, those two boys had to be dead for him to become king, right? Mm. Now, for Richard, to enact a murder like that when he was already the anointed king of England. Now, we say that now and it doesn't mean that much to us, but in those times, God was there to put that oil on him and give him his crown. He was now the legitimate king. He was also a new king. He'd only been king for a matter of months. So to then carry out and to think, okay, it's going to be worthwhile carrying out such a murder, Richard would be putting his crown in jeopardy.
I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, in which the life under discussion is that of Richard III. Philippa Langley, who led the search to find Richard's remains, has championed him, and Annette Carson is our expert witness. Now, Annette, we can agree that Henry VII, or the man who was to become Henry VII, had the motive to remove these two princes. We can see a motive for Richard too, but Philippa has argued passionately that Richard would have been a fool to have become involved in their assassination. Shall we just park that, leave that there, and go on to look now at his kingship? Was he a great king?
Most definitely he was. If we look, for example, at the pieces of good governance that he achieved during his incredibly short reign, they were quite staggering. I mean, for example, his first act as king was to call his judges to him and to decree that they dispense justice without fear and without favour for all members of society. There's a priest from Richard's time called John Rouse who spoke about Richard and what he was doing with his laws and his legislation. He said, "Prince Richard ruled his subjects full commendably, punishing offenders of his laws and oppressors of his commons, and cherishing those that were virtuous, by which discreet guiding he got great thanks of God and love of all his subjects, rich and poor." And what you can see from Richard's laws is that he was very clearly enacting against things like extortion and corruption and bribery, and he wanted to make it a much more fairer society. His laws were, you know, they were bold and enlightened, and they were clearly focused on making life fairer and more bearable for the ordinary people. And to give a sense of how Richard was regarded at the time, there's a quote from the Bishop of St. David's, Thomas Langton, who was writing in a private letter, and he was talking about Richard when he was on his progress. He says, "He contents the people wherever he goes, for many a poor man hath been relieved and helped by him. I have never liked the condition of any prince as well as his. God hath sent him to us for the well-being of us all." And it gives you a sense of the man that the people were seeing at the time.
Is it the view, Annette, of historians generally that he was a great king or that he might have become a great king?
There isn't a settled view. Every historian that you read will have a different view about it. Mm. Each historian has made up his or her own mind about the character and personality and nature of Richard III. So once you've settled on somebody's character and personality, then you carry through, yes, he was a bad man, and these laws were just hypocritical so that he could get past this government, past this particular parliament, and get on with doing the dreadful things he wanted to do. I look at the facts and I look at what I see in the statute books, and I see laws that are intended to help people. Why should I think that he was trying to double-cross people? It's very counterintuitive to say that somebody, you know, is proving himself a villain by passing good laws.
But one of the things I would say is that Richard only reigned for just over 2 years. So what I decided to do was to look at our greatest monarchs and what they have achieved, you know, the Elizabeths, the Henry the Fifths, the Alfred the Greats, that sort of thing. But to give them the same comparator as Richard, that is to give them 777 days. What did they achieve in the same time frame that Richard had? What is absolutely staggering is when you do that, they didn't achieve half of what this man did.
A powerful argument. He only had 777 days. Why? Why did he have to meet Henry on the battlefield? Take us through that, Annette.
Henry Tudor had thrown his hat into the ring to try to build on the discontent of the Woodvilles, but he was sent away with his tail between his legs. And that was in 1483. And the next thing he did was to go to France, which was in a state of conflict with England at the time. So he went and got into bed with the enemy. And France had a policy of destabilizing the government of England. And so they said, well, here's someone who thinks that he's entitled to the crown. We'll equip him with an army, we'll give him the money, we'll give him the resources, and let's send him over there to keep this Richard fella busy, and then he won't be invading France, will he? The French bankrolled him, he came to England, he, against all likelihood, he won the Battle of Bosworth, and the Battle of Bosworth, for me, was the last battle of the Hundred Years' War, and France won it.
So he's killed in the battle, he's buried. He lies underneath, well, what was to become a car park in Leicester. And, Philippa, you may be too modest to say this, but Annette tells me it was you who conceived of the search for his grave. It was you who gathered the experts and the evidence. You spent years knocking on doors in Leicester trying to get permission for the investigation. It was a long process, wasn't it? A long fight.
It was. It was. It was 4 years of research followed by 3.5 years to cut the tarmac.
So, you prepared a plan? You persuaded the city council to go ahead with it?
I did.
You raised the money?
Raised the money, yes. Got the experts on board, contracted the local archaeologists to do the digging work.
What first persuaded you that this was the place to look?
Well, I was researching Richard's life for a screenplay that I was writing, and I went to Leicester and I visited the social services car park there.
You had some reason to think that it was possible that he was there, did you?
That work was done by a chap called Dr. John Ashdown Hill, and his work showed him that the Church of the Grey Friars was in the northern end of the social services car park. I had this strange sort of intuitive feeling that I was walking on his grave. And so I then went off and did this 180-degree change in my research and started looking at his death and his burial. And the more I looked at it and the more I researched it, it became very clear that the northern end of the social services car park, where I had that experience, all the evidence, all of the historical sources were all leading to that area.
But what prompted the research was just your intuition that the body might be there?
Yes, it was that very strange feeling. It changed everything and made me want to look into it.
In a way, Annette, the discovery of the remains have reignited controversy over what kind of a king Richard was, which is not new.
It's a good thing.
Not necessarily recent. But when did it start? Was it in the 17th century that people tried to rescue his reputation?
Yes, it was exactly then, after nearly 120 years of Tudor rule. Sir George Buck, who was master of the King's revels at the court of James I, he took an interest in Richard III and he wrote a mighty great book. It's not very often quoted. It's very discursive and there's a lot of Latin in it. And George Buck was not taken much notice of.
But something did seem to catch on. There seems to be something about Richard that has fired the imagination of perhaps a minority of people who have become serious Ricardians. What is it? What is it about the man that makes you the believer that you are, and your society, for instance, whose membership I think has almost doubled since the discovery of the remains. What is it about him?
I think there's this irony that a man who sort of lived and fought for justice most of his life has suffered a particular great injustice. In fact, one of the greatest injustices of history, we could say. And I think the dig has changed everything because we've gone from being a very sort of small interest minority group to suddenly people knowing about Richard III now, people putting him into context and the public taking a great interest and looking into this man for themselves. And this is what has been the huge game changer, because we're not saying think like we do. Go and investigate. Make up your own mind. You decide what you think about Richard.
In a word, in a sentence, where do you think he should now be buried?
Well, we never had an issue with the place of burial. That decision was never in our hands. That was always for others.
Annette?
I'm disappointed at the way the authorities in Leicester have handled the trust that was consigned to them. I'm not awfully sure that the week-long event next year is going to be very dignified. So I have those reservations.
In our agreements before the dig got underway, we made it clear that if Richard was found and identified, that he would be coffined in a place of sanctity and rest of his own faith. And currently at the moment, the Leicester authorities are going to coffin him in a laboratory. And we are being overwhelmed with people of all faiths contacting us and saying, you know, this sets a pretty alarming precedent for a named individual to be coffined in a laboratory, particularly when we know his faith. And they think this is an appropriate and proper ritual for Richard to be coffined in a Catholic place of sanctity and rest. And well, we hope that happens.
I'll chip in. I think he should be buried in Westminster Abbey, where most of the others are.
If I can, I'll just give you a quote from the book that I wrote about the search for Richard. And it says, "When we finally lay Richard to rest, we do not seek to make him bad or good. Rather, we put a stop to the stigmatizing and vilification and allow for complexity. We also grant him the dignity of resting in peace, a dignity that 500 years of history have denied him."
The life and death of Richard III has been the subject of this edition of Great Lives. Philippa Langley was the proposer, and the expert witness was Annette Carson. Goodbye. Thank you for downloading this programme from Radio 4. There are some 250 other editions of Great Lives available on the Radio 4 website.